No, it's not Dancing with the Stars. It's Busted Pencils. Fully leaded education talk. Educated educators talking education. Johnny, come on. That music makes people want to dance. I can see them right now going like, this must be Dancing with the Stars. It's not Dancing with the Stars. It's
Breaking Pencils with Bald Guys.
There you go. Wow. There, you know, so last time we met, it was we figured out that Johnny's a teacher teaching teachers to teach, educated educators talking education, and now we got Busting Pencils with Bald Guys. Love it.
Wow. I also learned that Johnny is a well-coached coach coaching coaches from another program we did. So there's a lot of alliteration around here.
We got a little thing called the Teacher Coach Connection. Kind of like the Rainbow Connection, but a little more yelling.
Well, hey, so you know, yeah, it's Tim, Johnny, Jacob, and oh my goodness, who knew it could become Friday so quickly? And you know what that means, Pencil Busters. Trying to do my Johnny impression there. You know what that means, Pencil Busters. It's Jacob's Producer's Choice Day. Jacob, we are so glad you invited us on our show again today.
For Choo Choo Producer, Jacob's Choice, Chairman of the Board. Ow!
You now have two choices.
Chairman of the Board, Jacob.
Ow! Jacob, Chairman of the Boards.
I bet the board is spelled B-O-R-E-D.
We choose to go to the moon.
Life's full of tough choices, isn't it?
You chose poorly.
Tim, Johnny, thank you guys so much for coming on your own show. I really appreciate having you guys here.
Jacob.
Wouldn't miss it for the world.
That's it, man.
So, on the Producer's Choice show, sometimes we really like to zig when the show has been zagging. We come out with some really out-of-the-box topics. But sometimes on the Producer's Choice show, we also like to continue to develop on things we talked about during the week. And this week, it's going to be that type of Producer's Choice show. We talked about on Wednesday this big, wacky imposition of the 12 credit hour per semester demand from the Wisconsin legislature. Do we recall that conversation?
Woo. I do, Jacob. I do. I remember. Yeah. You know, the realization that the whole world now sees that, you know, Wisconsin legislature to the rescue, and mandating that faculty actually work 12 hours a week.
And that's exactly what we decided, that it's just a demand that you work at least 12 hours per week. No, folks, we talked about it. We had a great conversation on Classes in Session. I recommend you go back and listen to it if you haven't had the chance yet. But we talked about why that 12 credit hours per semester number is not exactly what it sounds. We talked about how teachers do a lot of work outside of the classroom with research and preparation for class. There's a lot more to it. But with all that being said, I think that a lot of people would agree that students, parents, and taxpayers do have a legitimate interest in knowing that employees of the government, which when you're a state employee at a state college, you are working for the people, they have an interest in knowing what it is that you do. I want to start off by just asking that simple question. Dr. Tim Slecker, as an educator, what do you do on an average day?
Oh, well, it depends. In my new position as a administration, I do a lot. But, you know, back to when I was a full-time faculty member, you know, kind of back to that to put the framing around that, when I was preparing future teachers to teach social studies, both elementary school teachers and future secondary social studies teachers, and when I was also teaching what we call the Foundations of American Education classes, both to beginning teachers and then an advanced graduate level. I mean, that was my workload, was to prepare And I actually, being at the State University of New York at that time, had a 12-credit-hour mandated teaching assignment, which meant I taught four classes for during any given week or every week during a 15-week semester. And I'll give you my schedule my very first year as a faculty member. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 9 o'clock till 9:50, social studies methods, 11 to 11:50, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, social studies methods, 1 to 1:50, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, social studies methods, Tuesday night, 5 p.m. to 8:30, education foundations for beginning elementary education teachers. That was a 3-hour class. So that makes up what you could say 12 credit hours of teaching. And so Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you could see what I was teaching from 9 to 1 teaching. On Tuesdays, I was teaching from 5 to 8:30 in the evening. And on Thursdays, I did all of that other stuff that Johnny was talking about, which is, guess what? My full-time job actually also required that I spend time with the students that I taught all those days in advising sessions, getting them in preparation for either the next courses, helping them understand the content we were going over, and also then writing and doing my own research to get myself published, because that was part of my job. And then at the same time, working in community with local public schools to do some American History School enrichment with teachers out there, because as Johnny pointed out, that was my service to the university. And I always think about service is my expertise is being put out in the public to free of charge, you know, in that sense. So that's a work week of a traditional faculty member who has to teach what is now being mandated by the Wisconsin legislature, a 12-credit-hour workload. So how's that for, you know, brass tacks?
Tim, it sounds like you work pretty hard, so I'm going to give you an approval stamp. You're okay. I'm going to move on with my inquisition here to Dr. Johnny. Johnny, tell us about your average day as a public educator.
Well, I'll take an average day. I have three types, Jacob, for my workload, and you can imagine. I like to keep it pretty tight to my schedule. So I'm pretty fortunate that I think I mentioned this in the show earlier this week, that I am on a contract as a professor, that during the school year, I am 40% of my time teaching, 40% of my time researching, and 20% of my time in service, which we talked about in the previous show, what that meant. But essentially for me, that means that 2 days a week, if we imagine, no one quite gets to have a 40-hour work week, but if you can imagine, 2 work days a week are focused on teaching. I teach my classes on those days. I hold study groups. There's some grad seminars. There's some time to do some tutoring with students that have difficulties in class or just need to talk through concepts a little bit more. And those days, Jacob, start promptly at around 7:20 a.m., and they often end around 7 p.m. Those 2 teaching days are pretty packed. Fortunately, though, I think most educators out there will agree. We said that in a previous show. Those are rewarding days because I love teaching. Sort of what, you know, really brought me into becoming a professor was how much I loved teaching and how much I was learning about it and could then teach other teachers about, or grad research students becoming educational researchers. So at least 2 days a week, that's what it looks like, 7 to 7, pretty close to that. I try and stick to it because too much work can sort of wear you down and lead you to burnout. The other 2 days a week, Jacob, I wake up around, you know, pretty early, work out, clear my brain, and I work on research. Typically for me, that can range anywhere for whatever stage my research is at, reading, writing, editing, giving interviews, transcribing interviews. Sometimes it's just listening to audio recordings of interviews, whether it be teachers or students or participants in a research study. That's qualitative research that I do. I'm working on the research. And those days, Jacob, are pretty much, start clocking around 8 and get going, take a half hour lunch at noon, and then it's back to it until we're on the show in the evening. So it's not as long as a day as my teaching days, but it's also a slog. It's pretty much sitting at a computer, right, and just grinding on whether it's writing or, it's reading or some kind of a formality aspect of the research. And then sprinkled in there is this the stuff Tim was talking about that doesn't get accounted for. Every day and every break starts and ends with just making sure you check your emails, which can be anybody listening can be quite a task for a professor. You get a lot of questions from students. You get a lot of, emails and queries and, also schedule meetings. And it's like emails constant. So if I don't have a routine for factoring in at least, half hour at the beginning of the day, half hour at the end of the day, usually 15, 20 minutes after lunch, and, any other break, just glancing at it throughout the day, you can fall behind. And one thing I think we all probably know about our professional world is even though email isn't the same as a text message where you could give a quick direct response, I like to say, 24 to 48 hours is the expiration date on an email. If you haven't responded to someone emailing you, if it's not junk mail, right, if it's a student or it's a colleague, within 24 to 48 hours, then I'm slacking at my job, right? So I take that pretty seriously. And then for me, at the point of my career, I'm at Fridays is when I schedule a lot of committee meetings where I work with other teachers to review our curriculum. We might talk about, what's going well in our program to certify teachers, what we need to work on, what kind of graduate program credentials need to change. That's when we're doing a lot of meetings. So Friday ends up being a pretty long day, despite popular beliefs that professors are, they're gone because they don't teach on Friday. We're pretty bogged down. At least all my colleagues, we're lucky enough to sort of earmark Fridays for meetings. And it's a slog of a day. It's a lot of meetings. It's a lot of collaborative work together. But it's also a joy because you get to check in with the other educators and researchers. And it's a great way to end the week. Talk shop about, what's worked well that week. What do we need to be working on? Are we meeting our goals and expectations? And we go from there. So I would like to say it's not a 9-to-5 job, but I try and make it. That's the blue collar scholar in me. I try and make it as close to a punch in, punch out kind of job as I can so that I can stay, strongly productive on taxpayer dollars. And that's something I believe in firmly as part of a democracy. Right. Me doing my work is practicing my civic duty, my democracy in action, teaching teachers, also doing research on school and schooling. So I take it seriously. I love it. And it's a grind. And I approach it the same way I approach being on a construction site, right, or being on a remodel job. It's not lazy work. It's hard work. Even if you're not outside, physically working all the time, your brain is working. Your hands are going. And Jacob, most recently, I tried to build in because I experienced burnout a few years ago because I used to not have this schedule. I used to go until the work was done, and that led me to burnout really quickly. But what I've tried to do this school year, in fact, I learned from other colleagues' research that the amount of sitting I do is actually really not good for me. So I've been starting to try and go on more walks, but when I take a break, and also I got a standing desk at work. So, I'm still not, I'll admit to all you listeners, I'm still not used to it. I don't feel as productive standing as I do sitting. That's just like the muscle memory. As soon as I sit at the computer, my brain knows it's time to write, right? So, I'm working on standing desk, and on my next move is I think I'm going to get a walking pad. So that I can be walking and like checking emails in my office. I'm pretty excited about that new move. Might be a New Year's resolution for me. Put a walking pad in my office. Did I answer the question, Jacob?
Yes, Johnny, you answered the question adequately and satisfactorily. and I'm going to give you another passing grade for being a hardworking teacher. That was good. Oof. And for a second, Johnny, when you're talking about, you know, oh, it's not good for my health to be sitting all the time, but I don't like the standing desk. When you started that next sentence, I thought you were going to say, so I'm getting a walker. I'm just going to pack it in. You know, this is not working out. These attempts to make this more healthy are just failing. So I'll commit to full walker.
Oh, that's not, I didn't tell you. I mean, I have the Chuck Norris Total Gym in the back of my office. You
know? Whoa.
Nice. Yeah. P90X.
I don't use it, but it's there.
It's always good to have just in case, you know, in case Chuck Norris were to show up. But Tim, something that Johnny touched on there that I think is something important to bring home to people, and our educators out there, they're already aware of this, but Johnny said he makes these efforts to try to get this to fit into that 9-to-5 type of range. But as a lot of people will know, and I think, Tim, you can tell me more, that's not necessarily something you can take for granted as a teacher, that work stops at that whistle at 5 p.m. Am I correct about that?
No, I mean, you're exactly right. Even teaching in traditional American K-12 public schools as a second grade teacher and as a fifth grade teacher, you know, okay, people are like, teachers, you know, they work from 9 o'clock and what, Slicker, when's school over? 3:15? My God.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's like, well, I get there at 7 to get ready for the students who are coming at 9 throughout the day teaching all day. You know, you're accumulating the work then of all of the things that they've done. And then at 3:15 after bus duty and maybe meeting with a few parents, then you try to do all of the work, you know, grading the papers, getting ready and kind of getting set up for the next day. But then sometimes realizing that at 6 o'clock, it might be time to say, you know what, I can come back here again at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning and start all over again. So, I mean, yeah, that is, you know, for people that talk about, you know, well, the teaching hours, you know, you hear 12 hours or wait, Slicker, you just said you teach like 3 50-minute sessions. So what the heck do you, hey, that's the act of physical teaching. There's preparation. There's afterwards interactions. There's continuing to work on assignments. So just to point that out, yeah, it really, really, you know, I've not met, and I will say this, a good teacher who ever works the clock, okay? Because if they work the clock, you would be a horrendously crappy teacher because it's just, you're not able. So again, back to that classroom teacher, if you showed up at 8:45 and left at 3:35 every day, your ability to be even a mediocrely bad teacher would be problematic.
I want to ask you this, Johnny, because this whole conversation, we're talking about the daily lives of teachers. And I think we saw from Tim's story and from yours and thinking about other teachers, it's not exactly a one size fits all thing. You know, you've got every day, these are the classes, and then there's a lot of more work that needs to get done at, I guess, a little bit at your discretion, but you also do have times that needs to get done by. There's all these different things going into it being a teacher when it comes to the workload. So a one size fits all 12 credit hours per semester demand put down by the legislature may not fit and make sense in terms of trying to make sure everybody's doing the things that they have to do. Now, given that, how do we properly keep educators accountable while eschewing ill-informed quotas and artificial metrics, Johnny?
Can you please repeat the question, Jacob?
I certainly can, because I've got it written on this notepaper pad in front of me. How do we properly keep educators, quote-unquote, accountable while eschewing these ill-informed quotas and artificial metrics?
Yeah, I like this, Jacob, because I think accountability is a really important thing, right? I think there is a myth, and every myth has some little bit of truth to it that gets the ball rolling, right? And there is a myth that, you know, professors especially are just out there kind of wandering around, bebopping through town, and you know, they pop into class and, you know, talk about something they know about and then go back to their strolling through, you know, college town and living the good life. You know, that just is sort of like a stereotype and myth. But some of the truth that helps lead to that is that by and large, it's one of the few professions I've been working in full time where you don't have a direct like boss. You do, but there isn't like a shift you're on. You're not necessarily like you have your office hours and you have your account, like accountability, but you're your own boss for the most part. You might have a chair if you're a faculty in a department, and the chair, of course, answers to the dean, and the dean's, you know, to the provosts and the presidents and all. There's like a chain of command on university campuses, much like at any school or any company, right? But professors have a lot of autonomy. And this is certainly linked back to that legislative push Tim's talking about. It's to, you know, remove that autonomy. And they're using this myth and sort of stereotype of the lazy professor or the like lackadaisical, non-hardworking professor to sort of push, you know, that erosion of autonomy. And Jacob, I think this is where I mentioned in our show earlier this week, some real creativity from leaders in higher ed, not necessarily creative and like make up a new system, but understand, I like how you put that, non-askewed ways to, you know, measure and be accountable for work. So like really these ideas like, hey, everyone must teach 12 credit hours. Well, that doesn't necessarily make sense for everybody, right? So I think there is some need to, you know, document a little bit more, maybe have conversations. I know great higher ed leaders do this. They talk to all their faculty members. They have a good sense of what they're working on through the weeks that they're working on those. We report, you know, what article are we most currently working on? What research proposals or grant proposals are we working on? How much time are we spending on those? So I think those things are really individualized and important. And I think it elevates and makes more meaningful the work that chairs and deans do, because they're in those managerial roles in higher ed. They can really say, I know what all my faculty can, in another sense, my workforce is doing on a day-to-day basis. They're either, you know, teaching these classes, which is real easy to see because it's in the schedule and on the, you know, there's a physical presence of it, or they're working on their research. And here's what their current research is. And a lot of every higher ed leader I know and that I look up to, they do this. They have conversations with their faculty all the time to be accountable. Now, currently, Jacob, there is a system that every faculty listening, anyone who's part of higher ed knows this, there is an annual review process, sort of like doing your taxes. Every year, once a year, we are required to report on in overarching what we've done over the past school year. So we like filing your taxes, like what were your earnings for the year? You know, what articles did you publish? What articles did you work on that are in review? What grants did you write? What curriculum did you work on? What did you teach in your courses? And what are some examples of assignments that you really feel proud of from last year? What are things that you hope to work on for next year? So setting goals. And we enter that into a computer system. It's a little impersonal, but it creates a report that our managers, like our chairs and deans, have a meeting with us where we sit down and we go over our review. And it's really thoughtful and self-reflective. And then you get feedback from your superior. You know, these words are kind of sometimes a little problematic, but they exist. There's a hierarchy, right? And they give us feedback. And, you know, we have good check-ins to make sure we're all aware of what's going on. And the myth I'm going to say here is that this is not happening. Because everywhere I've ever worked, this has happened. And everybody I talk to and listener out there who teaches in higher ed or, you know, or if you're a student, you can ask your professor about their annual review process. It happens every year and everyone knows about it. It's sort of like doing your taxes. It's like, we know this happens, this occurs, and it's a good system of accountability, Jacob, but it's also what is, you know, a summative form of assessment is also formative, to get nerdy about it in the education context. yes, I'm expected to meet certain criteria, just like a sales person is, like, sell so much. I'm expected to have published so much, you know, written grant proposals, have good feedback from my students, and teach a certain number of courses. And do I meet or exceed those goals? That's a discussion that's tracked and that I have with my superiors. And this is not unique to me or my institution. This happens at pretty much every institution of higher ed. So that, I think that works pretty well. One of the things that I think is in question at the moment is how important are things like publishing articles, are things like doing research. And there is a little bit of a battle right now culturally in our country about the value of research. And so, you know, to loop back around to Tim's discussion this week around, you know, the legislative overreach to mandate that every professor is teaching 12 credit hours is, to me, an action taken to devalue the research work and time that many professors are engaged in, and to honor that not as in addition to their teaching, but as important as their teaching, sometimes in a percentage wise, more represented in their labor than maybe the one course that they're teaching. But we all can't be only teaching or only researching. That's one of the really unique things about being a professor, is that you have a nice balance of both. And sometimes that balance aren't equal amounts.
Well, how about that, Jacob?
I think Johnny makes some interesting points, but I'm kind of wondering where you come down on this, Tim, because Johnny brought up the idea of the annual review as a means of tracking progress and keeping accountability for educators. But I wonder, how do you feel about it? Do you feel that the annual review is a good enough metric, or do you, if not our state legislators, Tim, perhaps some sort of strange oversight committee? Or, I mean, what do you think? Or are you more of an anarchic person on this front?
Antarctica, you mean like a big bear, cold?
Like a polar bear. Are you a polar bear?
Okay. No, I'm not an anarchist. And I know where you're coming, because I put here in the chat that I actually, all caps, hate accountability. And then also followed it up with, for real, no sarcasm here. Let me put it this way: when you do this, the whole word accountability just creates a sense of, as John we said, a superior oversight that has no trust in the professionalism, the intellectualism, the commitment of people to do the work they're supposed to do. And I'm also going to say that, you know, a lot of this comes from my anti-testing movement, where we're going to hold schools accountable. We're going to hold those teachers accountable. We're going to hold those kids accountable. And all of that really meant was, we're going to blame. And the word there too. And so before people go, my God, he just wants to do whatever it is that he believes is feels right. I know it comes across. No, what I want to talk about is, how are we going to maintain and create an inspiration with people to be responsible, to have a commitment to doing the work? When accountability gets introduced, it can turn into a sense of going, okay, I'm going to do what I know I have to do to stay out of trouble. And I think that just sets up a toxic environment. I know some people are going like, accountable, Tim, I'm just asking, you know, the taxpayers are paying your salary. Shouldn't they have some sense, and shouldn't somebody be able to demonstrate what it is that you do? Yes. So, but you legislators, you have a responsibility to the taxpayers. You have a responsibility to shepherd for me the opportunity to do my best work. I have a responsibility to put in every effort that I have there. And so there's a more of a, I'd say, less anarchistic and more utopianistic in what I'm trying to point out, but I'd rather be in that realm of what should be as opposed to what ought to be. So it's not anarchy I'm talking about. I'm actually asking for just a different culture, and the culture of accountability, I think, actually pushes people to not do their best work. How's that? And Johnny's like, wait. Go ahead, man. Go for it, dude. Go ahead.
So a few things. First, as an anarchist scholar, I'm going to nerd out for a second. The definition of anarchy, one of the simplest ones I could give is, you know, let's go denotation versus connotation, like the actual thing, not the myth of it. The myth of it being it's anything goes. And that's what Tim's referring to here as, like, he doesn't think it should be anything goes. Right. But anarchism is actually the practice of decisions being made by those directly impacted by the decision. And there is actually leadership within anarchy. It's just not authoritarian leadership. It's not hierarchical. Right. It's horizontal. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about that, Tim, I just have a question about, like, accountability. I get, like, again, the popular use of the term has been to instill punishment. It's imposed through an authoritarian kind of system,
right?
The idea of, like, your superior is trying to catch you not doing what you're supposed to, or it's trying to limit your, you know, your thinking or your work because you're just trying to meet quota and not really doing risk taking or courageous thinking or research, right? So it's murky, and I'm right there with you. I think we vibe on the same level with this. But I hesitate a bit to say, you know, that I don't like accountability, because I have to ask you, like, you like the Pittsburgh Steelers. Should they not have a coach?
Yes, they should have a responsible coach.
Well, yeah. So this comes back to accountability. So, Tim, you're speaking like you hate one-way accountability. So yes. Really great coaches will say accountability is a two-way street. I work hard for you. You work hard for me. That's sort of the mantra of, like, being part of a team, right? We trust one another to do the hard work. But also part of me, if I'm a coach or I'm a leader, right, is that my hard work is being responsible to making sure you have some structure so that it's not anything goes. Also, so that you have recognition for the hard work that you're doing, so that you can focus primarily on doing the hard work. And part of my hard work is making sure that you're not doing it in conflict with others. So, like, if I use the metaphor of Pittsburgh Steelers again, my kicker isn't also working hard to learn how to pass block. Actually, probably kicker needs to pass block on a fake kick, right? But I should say isn't working hard to learn to snap better. It's not his responsibility. And it's, like, generally oftentimes the coach's responsibility if they see him working really hard at some task that might not really be what he needs to be working hard at, to say, we already have guys who do that. So they're kind of in a managerial role. And it's hard in our culture to be a leader and not emphasize, like, not fall into authoritarian leadership. But certainly there is great leadership that is together with, not top down from, right? So I kind of still lean on, like, I want to reclaim accountability and emphasize, Tim, you know, I think what you're saying is you hate one-way accountability, where, like, legislation says do this. And there's no, like, yeah, I agree with you. We should, as faculty, be accountable to taxpayers' dollars. That's what pays our salary. But at the same time, our legislators should be accountable to those public as well, and to the service and labor of those doing teaching and research. So accountability is a two-way street. And that is certainly at the foundations of democracy, right? Democratic citizenship and popular sovereignty are core value of democracy, right? That government for the people, by the people, right? It hinges on that, like you had said, I would even agree, an anarchistic principle that everybody's working hard. I work hard for you. You work hard for me. Our work is different because we're in different roles. A pitcher on a baseball team has very different work than the catcher, than the center fielder. They're all working hard, but the baseball's head manager's job is to make sure everybody's in the right spot at the right times and doing the tasks that they need to be doing to be better at their position and their role on the team. So I'm a big fan of accountability, but I'm going to clarify and go back and say the kind of accountability Tim's talking about, two-way street accountability. I work hard for you. You work hard for me. We're only as good as our work together, which is different, Tim, than that superior top-down kind of stuff that, you know, I think it works best. I'll get share a quick story and kick it back to Jacob. I didn't hate principals, but as a teacher, especially as a new teacher, I constantly blamed the principal for a lot of stuff happening in my school. I was young. I didn't quite know how schools fully worked, though I had a hunch. I really blamed my principal. Oh, I can't do more project-based learning because my principal is, you know, really big on these tests that I have to teach to, and you know, the disciplinary system that I might like in my classroom, I can't do because my principal really wants to make sure I'm handing out a certain number of demerits. My principal. I blame my principal a lot. And then as I started to learn more about being a principal, started learning that, like, as some of the very principals I was blaming would be saying things like, I really would love my teachers to do more project-based learning and do different disciplinary, you know, management in their classrooms. I'm like, wait, the teachers are saying the same thing the principals are saying, but then they get into school and the principals are saying, my teachers aren't doing this. The teachers are saying, my principal doesn't support this. And so, you know, I think about what happens when we remove the hierarchy from those positions and we emphasize the reciprocity needed to be really good. And one of the things that happened is a group of teachers and I said, we are going to move from this school and we're going to join this school that doesn't have a principal, where the teachers lead that, like, the school. We know what we need. We're good at teaching. We know what kids need, and we're going to run the school. Tim, I'll tell you, about a year and a half into that experiment and that really awesome idea, we had a meeting together. And I think this is really good because it's the kind of accountability you're talking about, Tim. We sat in a circle, looked at one another, and we said, who's going to be our principal? Because we need somebody to kind of lead things. Just the simplest things, like when classes were happening, what, you know, who was responsible for what wasn't getting done. And we missed our principal. We missed someone being in that role. So we created a system where teachers took turns, you know, for half of the school year being the principal. And very quickly, that school, still very successful, has a teacher that's a principal for a few years. And then they pass that on to. So there's a leadership role that changes the labor, right? But I think is understood because those leaders were themselves teachers and will then become a teacher again. So they kind of have a different take about, I think, Tim, the kind of accountability you're talking about, right? That two-way street. I work hard for you. You work hard for me. But my experience has been leadership, non-authoritarian kind, right? Responsible, two-way, horizontal leadership is invaluable and is part of our everyday democracy.
Jacob.
Wow.
Help me. That's just, man.
There's a lot there. These
choice are deep, man, deep.
We're talking about two-way horizontal leadership and anarchy, and I'm advocating for an enlightened despot as hard as I can, but I think we've had a really good conversation
benevolent
today.
Dictator.
Exactly.
Enlightened despot, the benevolent dictator, the King Arthur.
I like a good Napoleon III, but we don't have time to get into that today, though Johnny, I think, has as close as he can to the Napoleon III mustache prepared there for us. Very nice. Guys, thank you for coming on your own show. It's always great to interview you and have a chance to pick some of the brightest minds in education. But I'm afraid there's time for one last 60-second type segment around here.
Let's go!
Gonna start with you, Dr. Tim Slucker, because Johnny just said a lot of words. Tim, what's the best part of your day as an educator/administrator?
Best part of my day. Actually, the best part of my day is when I get to be with others in a kind of a connection with a conversation that turns into a moment where I get to feel like those days of being in the classroom again, where the engaged dialogue between colleagues about creating new opportunities for future higher education students, being in that, as people say, there's a flow zone that happens, and it even happens for an administrator doing administrator work. You just got to get in that right mix of people and realize that actually it's not administration, it's leadership. And leadership is really, really rewarding.
This is the Dr. Johnny Lupinacci.
Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, how about you? What's the best part of your day?
Lunch. I love a substantial meal. No, I joke, but actually it's an important break in the day, and I do love it. And I love it especially because my teaching ends promptly at noon. And oftentimes we have lunch together. My favorite part of the day are the informal conversations that I get to have with my students. I love when they get to class early and I have music going, and they come in and we talk about what's been happening in their world, what's going on in the world, what we're going to be doing in class today. I love class, but then I love lunch because we all kind of take a break together and eat. And man, there's nothing more that I enjoy than a substantial meal.
Tim loves the flow state. Johnny loves lunch. I'm more of a recess guy myself, but I think there's time for one last thing.
And now it's time for your moment of zen. While some people think that dissent is unpatriotic, I would argue that dissent is the highest form of patriotism.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Producer's Choice. And don't forget, if you like this, you can get more Busted Pencils content. Just head on over to Apple, Spotify, or you can always find us at the Civic Media website or wherever it is you get your podcasts from. And Pencil Busters, don't you worry, because you can catch great downloads like this one all week long, Mondays for homeroom, Wednesdays for class and session, and every Friday for shows like this, Producer's Choice. And don't worry, because you can tune in to any of the Civic Media radio stations on Saturdays at 3 p.m. and catch the Civic Media's very best Busted Pencils broadcast. 3 p.m. Central Time. Tim and Johnny, Blue Collar Scholars, thank you for listening to Busted Pencils.